And good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And you are listening to Finding a Voice on CFRC 101.9 FM. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first hour, from an October 3rd book launch at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear a Irwin Strait reading, or I'm launching Flannery at the Grammys, a book about Flannery O'Connor's influence in contemporary music over the years. And in the second hour, from a September 10th book launch event held at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Armand Garnett Ruffo with his latest book, The Dialogues, the song of Francis Pigamagabo, bringing his libretto about the true story of this indigenous soldier in World War I to the page. So first, though, my usual start of the hour announcement, and it is occasionally that some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and move straight into, again, an October 3rd book launch at a Novel Idea Bookstore. Again, you'll hear Irwin Strait launching Flannery at the Grammys. Again, a book about Flannery O'Connor's influence in contemporary music over the years. And let's go ahead and bring it up. Here we go.
Hello, folks. Thank you so much for coming out for this evening. It's very, very moving to see you all. There'll be some moving parts here for this, and I will introduce my singer-songwriter friend, Gary Raspberry, who's been with me on this journey in the book and on Conversations of Flannery O'Connor for several years. Gary read through the manuscript and made some comments, and then when this launch was announced, Gary said, you know, I'll compose a song, you know, it's for the occasion. And this is one of the skills that Gary has. He's a Juno-nominated songwriter. And so we have, I was saying it's kind of like a mini course in Flannery O'Connor in a song.
Well, it took me a mini course, too.
It did.
Yeah.
So Gary, the Gary Raspberry here.
Here it is, everybody. I had many coffees with Irwin. Sadly, Irwin's not drinking coffee anymore, but that's another topic. But over the course of our many coffees together, Irwin was filling me in on Flannery O'Connor, who I knew really nothing about, and started to take me down the rabbit hole with him, this journey he's been on. I started to get worried, as probably many of you did who are friends and family of Irwin's, that he said, I just read another article, I've got to get that in the manuscript. And I said, Irwin, you got to let go of the manuscript. And he did, and here it is. Congratulations. I do have this little souvenir. This was done by Irwin's daughter. This is Flannery at the Grammys. And I think the publisher ended up basically taking, well, this is the before and this is the after. So, but this was the original peacock. Yeah.
And her first name is Flannery.
She's in the process of forgiving me about that. She goes by your middle name, Abby. She'll grow into it. Flannery's first name was Mary. She got married.
Rock on. So I've written this piece to celebrate this occasion. It's got a title that I thought Flannery would appreciate. It's called, this piece is called If I Die Before I Wake. And I thought, when Irwin and I talked about this song, I thought, well, it shouldn't be a problem. All I have to do is channel Lucinda Williams, Bruce Springsteen, Mary Gaucher, Sufjan Stevens, Lucinda Williams,
Nick Cave.
So here it is. Jesus on the edge of town, and Jesus in the temple throwing tables around. There was Flannery in her dressing gown. Yeah, there's Flannery in her dressing gown. Yeah, there's Flannery in her dressing gown. Dirty brown river running straight through town. Some are baptized, others drown. Typewriter ribbon, seven shotgun shells, two Baptist preachers, three Southern bells, blood on the trees, poison in the well. Blood on the trees, poison in the well. Blood on the trees, poison in the well. A tire iron tolling on an iron bell. The whole bloody story shot to hell. Chaff. She's got no rod, she's got no staff. Idolatry fattens a golden calf. Always someone polishing the golden calf. One woman riding against the grain. Nails on a chalkboard, blood in the rain. Everything done in Jesus' name. Let us bow our heads and pray. Pickup trucks, God-fearing strangers run straight out of luck. They were upright crystals to lightning struck. Yeah, they were upright crystals to lightning struck. Original sin, religious obsession, the dark catalog of countless transgressions, redemption, salvation, one final confession. Salesman in every town, and Jesus Christ nowhere to be found. Well, there's Flannery in her evening gown. Yeah, there's Flannery in her evening gown. There's Flannery in her evening gown. There's Flannery.
I'm Steve Lukacs, a friend of Irwin's, and we became acquainted while I was editor of The Whig, and Irwin was doing a column for us on words and language. And then in 2002, we became colleagues at RMC. And so we've known each other for quite a bit. And the subject that he's talking about today, literature, poetry, and music, is probably as old as human beings are, right? I mean, think of the word lyric. If you think of words to a song and music and the lyre and how the two accompanied each other. And there's that great observation by the French archaeologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, supreme mystery, the science of humanity, the invention of a melody, right? Or as Wordsworth put it a little bit more simply, the music in my heart I bore long after it was heard no more. We've all experienced that, okay? So Irwin's book is the achievement of a lifetime of scholarship, okay? And we've talked a lot about how you worked on the book, but the other part that also interests me is how this book is also a part of Irwin's lived experience in music and musical performance. And I've had the pleasure of having some of those occasions that we shared together. I remember in Lower Manhattan, standing in line for the Blue Note, jazz cafe, to listen to the great Stanley Clarke on his bass, about 6 feet away, nursing our cheap beers, right, because the drinks were too expensive. And then we came back to Kingston, and Irwin took me to a Merle Haggard concert, right? The great musicians of all time, right? And if as the prison capital of Canada, we should all know that song, Mama Tried, by Merle Haggard. If you don't know it, look it up. The other thing is that we went to a Bob Dylan concert right after he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, which we celebrated in the department. You know, here was Bob winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. And then finally, last Monday, you know, when we heard that Kris Kristofferson had just died, and I phoned up Irwin, or sent him an email, and then tried to phone him up and to say, hey, man, you got to get out here up by Lake Opinicon, where I'm living now. And I said, hey, we're going to watch Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid with Kris Kristofferson. And then we're going to listen to an interview with Kristofferson where he talks about composing me and Bobby McGee, which is in that movie Two-Lane Blacktop, which you've ever seen that one, right? So Irwin not only came out, but he brought his guitar with him. You know, where's Gary with his guitar? So, okay, another performance. And so before we started the movie, he takes out his guitar and he sings a couple of verses of me and Bobby McGee. And at the end, there were tears in the man's eyes because he sang it so wonderfully and movingly, which goes back to another Wordsworth hymn saying, what we have loved, others will love, and we will teach them how. So Irwin, come and teach us how.
Thank you, Steve, for that generous introduction. I don't really want to, you don't have to love Flannery O'Connor when you come to the evening here. There are lots of reasons maybe not to do that. Thank you, Gary, for that song and for the conversations that we've had. And I want to thank all of you for coming out. There's, you know, many things you might be wanting to do with an hour on a Thursday night, but here you are. And so thank you for choosing to come out for this event as well. And thank you to the Novel Idea strings of book launches that many of us have been to here. Novel Idea is such an important place for writers and readers to gather in this city. So thank you to them for hosting of this. Many of you have been part of the journey here in various ways, finding places, giving me places to write over the too many years it took to produce this book. Stephen Ann's place out in the Pinnacan was a place to write for a full month one time, and it got a lot of pages filled, and bird feeders as well. And also, Daniel and Teresa, where are you? Thank you for allowing me to spend some time in your cabin. I had to get out of the clutteredness of other places to write. So I want to thank several of you who are mentioned in the acknowledgments and helping me in the journey with this book here. I want to particularly thank editor extraordinaire, Maureen Garvey. Maureen was with me at the beginning of this book. Out my prose and some of my reasoning, and here the book is a much better book because of Maureen's hand in it. I also want to thank the Military College, RMC, and tonight the new principal, Jill Scott, is here. Jill is here. And Jill, this book would not have been published the way I wanted it if it was not for generous research bursaries at the college. I was very generously awarded monies that are needed to pay permissions to quote song lyrics, very expensive proposition. And so I would not have had the book I wanted to publish if it were not for, you know, timely research bursary funds and the CDARP, the internal funding we get. So this book owes a lot to the research environment at the Military College that enabled the book. So thank you, Joe, on behalf of all those there that enabled that. And of course, I need to thank my long-suffering family. My spouse Susan is here tonight. Where are you, Susan? There, and two of our children, Sage, is here, and Jesse and his fiancée over here. I have a line that concludes the book, you know, acknowledging the fact that, you know, there were times in the production of this book when a good husband and father was hard to find. Little Flannery O'Connor illusion. So that journey is over, and you stood beside me in it. Thank you. Flannery O'Connor said that she had no ear for music. She said that she had the original tin ear and had no ability to appreciate music at all. So you can imagine the irony, the considerable irony, that she's had a sizable influence on an A-list of singers, songwriters, pop musicians, and Gary listed some of them, including Bruce Springsteen, Lucinda Williams, Nick Cave, PJ Harvey, Sufjan Stevens, indie pop artist, U2's Bono, seriously influenced by O'Connor, as well the band REM, and to some extent Tom Waits. So she's had this considerable influence, and all the more ironic because she seems to not have understood or appreciated music until near the end of her life, which I'm going to reveal. And the book title, Flannery at the Grammys, is taken from the fact that she did appear at the Grammys. In the second Grammy Award for the Joshua Tree that U2 had in 1988, their guitarist, The Edge, read from a list of people that had influenced the album, starting with the two Nobel Peace Prize winners, Desmond Tutu, the then Archbishop of South Africa, Martin Luther King, Bob Dylan, and fourth from the top, Flannery O'Connor. And I was in contact with members of the U2 organization who said, you could write a book about Flannery O'Connor's influence on U2 and Bono. That's for someone else to do. I've got just a little bit of a section here on that. So the title comes from the fact that Flannery O'Connor was mentioned at the Grammys, and that many of the musicians here are multiple Grammy Award winners. Those who've known me for many years know that I've been working on Flannery O'Connor, and you may not know very much about her, and that's what I discovered recently. So if you're here and you don't know much about who Flannery O'Connor is, I've got a little potted bio on her that I'll read, and then some things about what drove me to write this book. So, a celebrated and in some quarters controversial American writer, Flannery O'Connor was a devout Catholic whose active faith informed everything she wrote. A native of Georgia, she had an uncanny gift for creating compelling fiction about the world of the Southern Baptist Bible Belt, spanning the post-war years leading up to the civil rights advances of the mid-1960s. She died in 1964 at age 39 from complications of disseminated lupus, a debilitating immune deficiency disease that claimed her father when she was a teenager and from which she suffered for the majority of her writing life. In her brief lifetime, O'Connor published two short novels featuring Southern religious fanatics, Wise Blood in 1952 and The Violent Bared Away in 1960, a collection of 10 short stories, A Good Man is Hard to Find, 1955, and 7 personal essays, mostly on the art of writing fiction, her brand of fiction. O'Connor's second collection of 9 stories, Everything That Rises Must Converge, was published posthumously in 1965. Her corpus of short fiction, including published chapter excerpts from her novels and stories from her MFA thesis, was issued in 1971 as Flannery O'Connor, The Complete Stories, and won a National Book Award for Fiction, an exceptional conferring of this honor for a work by a deceased author. O'Connor's complete corpus of published fiction, along with selected essays and letters, is available in the Library of America series in a single volume, Flannery O'Connor Collected Works, and it's one of the publisher's best-selling volumes. So that's a bit about who she was and her times. And as all research begins, it begins with a problem or a question. And by the way, I did not set out to write a book about Flannery's influence on pop musicians. I was having fun going to conferences, just doing one-offs and playing, you know, a little bit of PJ Harvey or some punk music and having a conference paper, until one seasoned O'Connor scholar who had several of these said, you know, I think you've got a book there. And so I had that might be a good idea. So we went ahead with it. But here, all research begins with a question, and here's the question that prompted my book. Why a devout Catholic woman writer of Southern Gothic stories and novels featuring largely unlikable characters and with plots invariably marked by violence and murder would have such strong stock and visibility in contemporary popular culture is surely a matter of considerable curiosity and significant import.
O'Connor's religious orthodoxy and seemingly regressive views on matters of race and gender, so counter to the ideologies of present times, would tend to make her more a cultural pariah than a kind of contemporary prophet figure, as some regard her. Why, then, have highly influential and successful pop music stars, Bruce Springsteen, R.E.M., U2 among them, invoked her as an influence on their art and vision? And the chapters in this book attempt to answer that question. Before I suggest some of the answers I give to that, I think... And I've just come back from a book tour. I had a book tour in Georgia, and I was on the soil. I could ask this question of people who knew. I asked, you know, can you think of another modern American author who's had that kind of, to use the phrase of one reviewer, oversized impact on popular music and popular culture? Now, let's grant the fact that 100 years before Flannery, the Gothic stories and rather twisted psyche of Edgar Allan Poe left its mark on the culture. I don't think she'll ever eclipse Poe. All of those B horror movies that we watched, by the way, Poe is the favorite author I've learned of heavy metal and death metal lyricists. So he's got his own genre there. But there's so much of Poe out there. But next to that's a 19th century writer. In the 20th century, I think there is this, to use the phrase that my friend June Skinner Sawyers used, this oversized impact that Flannery O'Connor has had on popular culture, and that is curious. And I'm going to suggest a couple of ways in which that might apply to the singer-songwriters and bands that I've mentioned. Just a few things about Flannery. Pop culture figures that she's influenced. Both Tommy Lee Jones and Conan O'Brien did their honors theses at Harvard on Flannery O'Connor. You recently have Stephen Colbert speaking with Ethan Hawke about the movie that some of you went to see, Wildcat. And Colbert says, well, my mother read me Flannery O'Connor stories. I'm a big fan as well. And you can go on YouTube and hear Stephen Colbert reading a Flannery O'Connor story on stage. The Coen brothers are fans. Martin Scorsese has recently been in conversation with Springsteen and said, you know, I read a couple of pages from Flannery O'Connor's collected letters several nights a week. You know, that's kind of a wisdom book. So just a little bit about O'Connor's reach into some of the makers of culture here. She's had that influence. The book that I started and I'm not going to do was to explore O'Connor's influence on the great white North. You know, our Nobel laureate and recently disgraced Alice Munro began her writing life by retyping Flannery O'Connor's stories, hoping that the syntax and story structure would just kinetically communicate themselves to her as she wrote. I was educated, had a creative writing degree with someone named W.P. Valgertson, Bill Valgertson, and his protege was Kinsella, Bill Kinsella. Of Shoeless Joe and Field of Dreams. They had a little society called the Enoch Emery Society, and the only requirement of joining that society that was an unstinting admiration for the works of Flannery O'Connor, and I started to do some research. Kinsella had the Enoch Emery Society and all the who's entries for him, along with all the literary societies. So on the Canadian front, several writers that, you know, that have shown and testified to evidence of O'Connor's influence, and our own and beloved late writer Stephen Hyten. Those of us who knew Stephen often referred to O'Connor in interviews. In his workbook of artist statements, she's referred to twice, and some of you were at the posthumous launch of Instructions for the Drowning, and you could hear his partner Ginger Farren say and allude to Flannery O'Connor and the kind of revelatory violence that were in Steve's stories. So locally, Steve is someone who also acknowledged O'Connor's influence. So I had plans for that book. There's a Flannery O'Connor book called Flannery's O'Connor South, written by Robert Coles, the child psychologist. Flannery O'Connor's North. I promise, Susan, I'm not going to write that book, but it could be done. I was going to I'll just skip that. I was going to show the book had another genesis. No, I'm going to do this just because I owe Nancy Douglas this, and I thought Nancy was going to be here tonight. Oh. The book had another beginning with another publisher
and I was working with visual artist Nancy Douglas, and we wanted to create a cover that readers would spend 20 minutes reading before they opened the book. And some of you know Nancy. Nancy is the second authority on Flannery O'Connor in this town. She just so deeply invested in her and created this collage cover of O'Connor. And at that time, I had not discovered Nick Cave and P.J. Harvey. And there's another chapter in there with a Southern gospel singer named Kate Campbell, an early reviewer of the book with the current publisher, said this individual who has 2,000 words in your book needs a chapter, and indeed she did. So just want to acknowledge that there is this previous iteration of the book. And by the way, the previous publisher didn't like the title. They weren't going to publish it as Flannery at the Grammys, and this is a busy cover. But that Nancy did this. And it did have some, bear some fruit. We got a detail from the picture on the cover of the annual journal for Flannery O'Connor. So I just want to acknowledge Nancy was part of the journey in the first part of the book with me. Okay. How we doing? Okay, I write in the beginning of the book that this influence that O'Connor has on current popular culture both begs and perhaps beggars explanation. And I offer in my introduction a couple of things I think bring this collection of singers, songwriters, and bands together. And the first thing is that they are, several of them are, in O'Connor's terms, Christ-haunted. This is a term that she used about the South. She said the South is a Christ-haunted place. And by that, I understand her to mean it's if you're Christ-haunted, you have some knowledge of what the Christian salvation story is. You might have encountered some of its doctrinal truths, but rejected its mystical imperatives. You must be born again, the Gospel of John. O'Connor, in her own literary manifesto, The Fiction Writer and His Country, published early in her life, states her case as a writer who holds strongly to theological truths. She says, "I see by the standpoint of Christian orthodoxy. This means that for me, the meaning of life is centered in our redemption in Christ, and that what I see in the world, I see in relation to that." Not an easy position to take in a post-Christian or post-God society, but Flannery was adamant. And I, after being very close with her text for years, I can say everything in Flannery O'Connor, converges on the figure and fact of Jesus. Flannery O'Connor's famous story, "A Good Man Is Hard to Find," that so many of us have taught in English classes or had to read. That's the misfit's problem, right? What am I going to do with the fact that there's a God man who raised from the dead? So O'Connor brings that to the foreground of all she writes. And for the majority of the singer-songwriters in this book, sometime in their lives they were either stumbled by or bound by some form of the Christian religion, and in many cases in various toxic and extreme forms. So if you've read Bruce Springsteen's biography, he talks about the rather constraining Catholic childhood he had. He talks about abuses that he faced in parochial school, being struck by nuns stuffed in a garbage can. He dropped the chalice during the Mass once. The priest knocked him down. And I think you have to cut the rug out if that ever happens too. So Springsteen, abuse that was part of his childhood. Lucinda Williams is descended from fire and brimstone Methodist preachers. Her mother's father was such, and that left a mark on her own soul and on this unstable mother who was addicted to drugs and had mental health problems. And Lucinda refers to some abuses she faced as a child in a very difficult childhood. Tom Waits' mother, after divorcing her husband, hauled Waits off to the Quaker church she belonged to as a teenager, and I think, like one Flannery O'Connor's characters, Parker, in one of her finest stories, I think he fled after that. So in the book, that Christ-hauntedness and some encounter with some fundamentalist or extreme religion, forms of the Christian religion, unites most of the writers that I deal with in a chapter-worthy sense. And in fact, several of them, Springsteen included, Lucinda Williams, someone named Father John Misty, some of you know him, identify them, find themselves in her fiction, find somebody like themselves. David Bazan of Pedro the Lion, people find themselves in their fiction, and they help to explain themselves somewhat by reading about her Christ-haunted characters.
Here's a Flannery O'Connorism. To the hard of hearing you shout, and to the almost blind you draw large, startling figures. And O'Connor shocked a lot of her readers, particularly her co-religionists. In fact, I've edited a book of reviews of Flannery O'Connor, and the most virulent, vituperative, two good V's, reviews of Flannery O'Connor are by her co-religionists and are published in Catholic journals. In fact, she was called an enemy of the church, and they were sure that she was working for the other side, some of them. But O'Connor shocked readers, I think, because she understood, or she saw that the sacred could be mediated through the profane, that the things that we might understand as what she called means of grace were boundless. It could be almost anything, and O'Connor does this time and again in her stories. There's an oversexed teenage girl, a nymphomaniac, as she's called in the story, who embodies, in my reading, divine love. It wants consummation with the 40-year-old virgin historian Thomas in this story. And O'Connor also has a story in which pigs, hogs, pulse with a kind of secret divine life in a story called Revelation. And another story, a woman's soul is associated with a false leg that gets stolen from her. So some very unsanitized and profane ways in which O'Connor sees spiritual truth being translated. So I think that's part of the appeal that O'Connor might have to people who have some Christ hauntedness, some relation to some kind of religious or spiritual sensibility, the fact that there are so many ways in which that might be manifest, and O'Connor does that in her work. Just one example from Mary Gaucher's song, A Wheel Inside the Wheel. She has a soul parade of Mardi Gras revelers that include, drag queens, transvestites, a voodoo priestess. They're all marching their way down Eternity Street. They're making their way. And it's similar to a vision at the end of one of O'Connor's best stories, Revelation, where the central character watches all the freaks and weirdos and lunatics ascending the ladder to heaven while all the good people like her are holding up the back end. So this idea of the sacred within the profane is quite remarkable in Flannery O'Connor's works, and I think that draws some of the artists that I'm talking about. I've also argued in the book that there's a kind of erotic theology in Flannery O'Connor. I'm waiting for the reviews. There's a certain prurience in O'Connor's circles. They don't talk about sex in O'Connor, but it's there, and it's there in ways that I think suggests a link between the sexual and the spiritual. There's a story that she has called A Temple of the Holy Ghost. And in that story, there is a fair at a freak show, a hermaphrodite. And as the hermaphrodite lifts their dress to reveal the bisexed body, the young woman is thinking about that. And she's in mass watching the priest open the monstrous with the host inside it. And O'Connor's making some equation between these things. This is the body of Christ, she says. And that's a shocking, shocking image in her work. So, I'm waiting for the reviews on my argument that erotic theology is there. And back, by the way, the conversation afterwards, largely just transgressive sexuality in Flannery O'Connor, transgressive forms of sexuality, pederasty, homosexual rape, prostitution. Flannery was dealing with sex in ways that were just not acceptable in the 50s when she was doing that, writing that. And my last point, and then I'll take some questions. I did a dissertation here at Queen's on Flannery O'Connor's stories, and as I was winding things up, it was involving some semiotic criticism and ways of reading her texts. My thesis supervisor said, I think you should argue that one of the things about Flannery O'Connor's voice is that it's prophetic. And I was very reluctant to do that. How do you defend that? I still feel a little bit odd about saying that, but I want to say that one of the things I think in Flannery O'Connor that might have that staying power is that people recognize there's something in her that might be defined in how we use the word prophetic. Her prayer journal, something that she wrote when she was at the Iowa Writers Workshop in 1946, 1947, was published in 2013. And it's the book that Maya Hawke read and that precipitated the film that her father made, Wildcat. It comes from that early writings and prayers of this young writer who is having this sense that there's some divine source and purpose to her craft, and that she has been given a kind of spiritual gift to write, and she muses in her journal on that. And she came to see that what the kind of writer she is, the one that wants to plumb mystery at the heart of human meaning, she says that writer has to have what she called prophetic vision. I've been in O'Connor's manuscripts. She did not plan any of her stories, did not know where they're going. There are about, 2,000 manuscript pages for a 140-page novel, Wise Blood. She was just sniffing things out and showing up at the typewriter for 3 hours a day and, wanting to know what it is that she could write and make some sense of. So a mystery at the heart of her writings may account for the preternatural power that the late critic Harold Bloom says is recognizable in her fictions. And the boss himself read O'Connor's works and remarked in an interview, "She's just incredible." So before I read something, I want to say one last thing about Flannery O'Connor, in that in an interview that she had late in her life, she was asked about the difficulty of publishing her kind of fiction in a kind of a post-God society. And she remarked, "You don't write only for now." And she said, "I can wait 50 to 100 years for my stories to be understood." And that statement still stuns me. Who says that? How can you say that? That must be someone who understands that she had a kind of prophetic voice. "I can wait 50 to 100 years for my stories to be understood." Now I'm going to read a little bit. And then I'm going to have some time for some questions. And then there are books here. And I'm going to read from the coda to the book. And I'll fill in a few things here because it reflects back on the book. It's called Going to Rock, Rattle, and Roll. And I've got a further argument as to why maybe rock and roll songwriters find some sympathy with Flannery O'Connor, in the sense that I think she understands the spirit of the rock and roller in a character she's created. So I'll read and skip some paragraphs here in the end of this book. Within her small corpus of short fiction, Flannery O'Connor created one rock and roll rebel, a juvenile delinquent named Rufus Florida Johnson, the antagonist of her late story, The Lame Shall Enter First. Her second longest story, next to her novella, The Displaced Person, it is a kind of small-scale recasting of characters and themes developed in her second novel, The Violent Bear Away. The do-gooder social worker Shepherd in the story is a version of her virulent secular humanist George Raber in the novel, a self-described good man who is not so. Shepherd's intellectually vacant 10-year-old son Norton is a higher-functioning, quote, dim-witted child than is Raber's evidently mentally disabled boy, Bishop. Her roustabout and reluctant prophet character Rufus Johnson, writes O'Connor in a letter to novelist John Hawks, is, quote, one of Tarwater's terrible cousins. Tarwater is the youthful prophet in the making in her second novel, The Violent Bear Away. And like Tarwater, Rufus appears to be running Jonah-like from his prophetic calling. The emblematic surname Johnson signifies his pedigree as a prophet in the making. Rufus is a son of John, O'Connor's prophet of choice, the Baptist. Unintentionally, surely, but fortuitous to the argument at hand, his family name and initial also link Rufus to one of the progenitors of American rock, 1930s Mississippi bluesman Robert Johnson, about whom O'Connor likely knew nothing. Yet even the description of Rufus' hair, quote, his thin, dark hair hung in a flat forelock across the side of his forehead, identifies him with the coiffed rock and roll teen idols of the late 1950s and early 1960s. Moreover, and evidently, Rufus is identified with Elvis Presley. Her caveats aside, O'Connor was not completely oblivious to the popular culture and early rock and roll music of her day. She likely saw Elvis' first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show in September 1956, a performance that surely informs Rufus' hip-swiveling Elvis imitation shortly after he enters Shepherd's house. Rummaging through the dresser drawers in the bedroom of Norton's recently deceased mother, Rufus retrieves a faded corset and straps it on like a campy androgynous rock performer. He begins to snap his fingers and turn his hips from side to side as he sings an imitated version of Shake, Rattle, and Roll, the million-selling rock and roll hit of 1954 by the curly forelock Bill Haley and his Comets, also recorded by Elvis. Going to rock, rattle, and roll. Can't please that woman to save my doggone soul, he sings. In Rufus Johnson, O'Connor appears to understand the sensibilities, familial and social forces, and often conflicted soul of the rock and roller. Johnson uncannily shares many characteristics with the O'Connor-influenced contemporary music figures examined in my book. And I'm not going to, I go into the Christ hauntedness part of that I've just talked about in these characters and give examples, and also a bedevilment. I'll just give you a little teaser if you want to read that part of the book on punk and heavy metal music that Flannery has influenced and is quite considerable. I say rock and roll can be a highway to hell or a stairway to heaven, and songwriters and bands in this study appear to have taken O'Connor along for the ride on both journeys. Bruce Springsteen has remarked that the Catholic doctrines and sacramental practices that informed his upbringing created in him what he calls an internal landscape, a religious sensibility and underlying redemptive narrative that has shaped his songwriting and directed the lives of the characters in his many first-person narrative songs. O'Connor literalizes the metaphor of an inwardly informing and nourishing gospel truth by having Rufus Johnson eat pages of the Bible in a remarkable scene of defiant spiritual transformation. To confirm to the God-denying shepherd that he truly believes the biblical doctrine of salvation, that, like the evangelist after whom he is named, he has been explaining to shepherd's son, Johnson takes the Bible he has been reading at the dinner table, tears out several pages, and swallows them, exclaiming three times, "I believe it." Like the religiously tattooed O.E. Parker, this is a character in one of her best and last stories called Parker's Back, who gets a Byzantine dour Christ tattooed on his back, ostensibly to please his fundamentalist wife. Like the religiously tattooed O.E. Parker, Rufus too becomes an emblem of the Word made flesh, a Christ one, his transformation symbolically transacted as he literally devours the scriptures, his prophetic destiny accepted and perhaps complete. That O'Connor crafted a story in the early 1960s featuring a young prophet rock and roller belies her professed ignorance of the popular culture of her day. While claiming to have no ear for music, O'Connor had enough familiarity with the pop songs of the early 1960s to remark in a letter written 15 February 1964, quote, "All classical music sounds alike to me, and all the rest of it sounds like the Beatles." Less than a week earlier, on 9 February, the Beatles made their celebrated American debut on the Ed Sullivan Show, a culturally transforming media event watched by more than 70 million Americans, among them, presumably, O'Connor. I've learned she had a television in her room at that time. So O'Connor's comic exclamation that she was possessed of, quote, the original tin ear and had no appreciation whatsoever for music of any kind appears to be somewhat overstated. In possession of a cast-off record player sometime after Christmas 1963, a gift from a group of Dominican sisters in Atlanta, O'Connor resolved, quote, to educate herself, if possible, end quote, in the meaningful pleasures of music. Over what would prove to be the final months of her life, she made her way through a box of both classical and pop records sent by her friend and correspondent Thomas Stritch, who was a professor of American Studies at Notre Dame. In a letter to Stritch dated 11 February 1964, she asks him to send some music reviews that he had written, explaining, quote, "I would like to see how knowledgeable folks talk about it." And she confesses remarkably, "This is the first time I've listened to music except when I was at Yaddo, a writer's colony in upstate New York that she had left 15 years before in February 1949. In one of her last letters, written just weeks before her death, shortly after midnight on 3 August 1964, O'Connor confides to Stritch, quote, "The records are a real boon, and when I'm not working, I'm listening to them." She remarks somewhat knowingly on enjoying a classical record with, quote, a four-hand Chopin four-hand piano Chopin thing and adds, quote, there's a point in it where the peafowls join in. Flannery O'Connor collected birds and particularly was taken with peacocks, and at one time she had 40 of them on the family dairy farm just outside. Can you imagine the cacophony of 40 peacocks? A very significant bird for her. Widow Connor, like her fellow Southern novelist, Catholic, and friend Walker Percy, have written a fan letter to Bruce Springsteen, or agree with Father Andrew Greeley, who labeled Springsteen, quote, a Catholic Meistersinger. She had no qualms about letting young Lucinda Williams chase her peacocks. Would she have finally purchased that new record player she once considered buying rather than the pair of swans she ordered instead and listened over and over to Williams' Grammy Award-winning rockabilly song, Get Right With God, with its imagery influenced by Wise Blood? Would she have nodded approvingly on hearing Mary Gaucher's Wheel Within the Wheel with its motley parade of freaks and outsiders, as in Ruby Turpin's vision, winding their way heavenward along, quote, Eternity Street? Had she lived a fuller life in years until the turn of the century, as might have been expected for an American woman born in 1925, she would have discovered in the works of contemporary bands and songwriters whose art she has influenced that, like the music she came late to appreciate, there are places in their songs where, again, the peafowls might join in. Thus end. Thank you for listening. Have on the table here a collection of just about half of the CDs that I've collected that have O'Connor's influence, everything from folk, blues, rockabilly to industrial metal and synth pop, dance pop. She's got a range of artists that have found inspiration in here. So you can peruse some of these. And I've got about 40 recordings that I've collected that bear some evidence of O'Connor's influence on their art. I'll take a few questions before we have some noshing and there are books available.
I have a question about the Prayer Journal.
Yes.
Which I know, but
yes.
You said it was published in 2013. Why
yeah.
so late? Why?
The O'Connor estate was very, very, very protective of her, and in some cases for good reason. So they were protective of her, and it was only a very good friend of the family who had known Flannery when she was young who was given the right to edit the journal and publish it. It's published as a facsimile journal, and yeah, you know it. So the estate is highly protective of her. In fact, Flannery scandalized the family when I went down to do doctoral research with Susan and some babies back in early 90s. Milledgeville had a directory to all the famous people in Milledgeville. Oliver Hardy grew up there, and there was a famous murder there that was made into a book and a film called Paris Trout. But there was nothing in the brochure about Flannery O'Connor. She'd you know, satirized them. She'd held them up for, they felt scorned. And the family was mortified by some of the works that she published. So there's this protectiveness about her, and even the town showed a early disregard for her. Now, I just came back from the family farm. There is a $3 million interpretive center on the Flannery O'Connor farm that the state of Georgia has done, and Flannery O'Connor is a big deal. Her the 100th anniversary of her birth is next year. There are major events planned in America and a big conference in London, England as well. So Flannery's come into her own, but that's been in just in the last 30 years or so. And she was a very minor writer in her day, to recognize.
How much of her work is still available?
All of it. And it was very little. And I said, all of her work can be had in a Library of America volume. She published 19 short stories in her lifetime and two novels and a collection of essays. You can get Flannery O'Connor in one volume. Small body of work.
What's your favorite Flannery O'Connor influenced song?
I like the dance pop here, you know, because that's the kind of guy I am, right?
Yeah.
There's a Canadian band here called Wild Strawberries. They toured with Lilith Fair. Sarah McLachlan's Lilith Fair. And they've got this great little dance tune called Everything That Rises Must Converge. And that's one of my favorite ones. And if you listen very carefully, deep in the mix, just as there's a scattered outro going, where the lead singer singing Fla Fla Fla, you can hear Flannery. I was corresponding with them. They wanted to name their daughter Flannery, but the family objected. I'm glad we got away with it. But they named her Georgia instead. So this is a couple that lives a little north of Toronto. They had a life for many years in this synth pop band with Lilith Fair, and they still make music. That's my favorite one, dancing to Flannery.
What initially piqued your interest in Flannery? What was the spark that started it all?
In my scholarly journey?
Yes,
that's a good point. In fact, I came to do a PhD strictly because I saw a problem in Flannery O'Connor. I saw the problem of somebody who holds to religious orthodoxies, all of these mysteries, these ineffable, intangible things. And I thought, how can fiction bear the weight of that? This is mystery. Where is it? You know, and there are book length monographs of Flannery O'Connor said, I don't see anything here, Flannery. Mystery isn't a category. I don't find anything here other than I can read you in a Freudian way. There are people who say, I look for it, but I don't see it. I went there because I thought, you know, that's the problem. How do you do that? And I spent a dissertation trying to figure out how that might have been done at a language level. Flannery says the one thing we have in common always between writer and reader is the text, it's words. All we have is words, she said. So it's words that have to bear the freight of whatever meaning you're trying to communicate as a writer. And I suggested that there were strategies that she used at a word level to intextuate, there's a good word, the religious mysteries that she tried to dramatize in her stories. So that's what got me going. How do you do it, Flannery?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Erwin, is part of the answer to that just the violence? I mean, if you look at Christianity, there's the crucifixion, which is a pretty violent thing, right? Which is supposed to lead us to all kinds of good things like salvation and stuff, but what we remember is the violence.
Yeah.
And most of the writers and certainly the movie people you talked about are,
yeah.
I mean, Scorsese,
yeah.
Peckinpah that we watched the other
That's
night.
Right.
You know, the violence. Is a big part of it. Is that what you can hold on to, and then you're looking for some kind of, you know, salvation in it? If you think of Wild Bunch, you know, Sam Peckinpah. I don't know.
Well, Flannery kills somebody in most of the stories, except the ones that she was doing at the end of her life, and death is a moment of revelation and epiphany for her stories. She was moving somewhat beyond that. I think in some of her better stories, Parker's Back and Revelation, she lets her characters live. I had this conversation just a week ago with someone down in Georgia and I was about to go to Savannah, and Flannery O'Connor's childhood home is right across the street from one of the major Catholic churches there, St. Joseph's Church, and there's a story that she's conceived in the shadow of the steeple. And she went to Mass every day as a child there, and this individual who was a federal prosecutor told me, you know, every day she went into that church, and you should look at the Stations of the Cross in that church. They're highly violent. And they are. I took pictures of all of them. Mm. There are hands raised with whips. The Christ is actually on a leash being pulled in some of the images. The nails are there and the hand is up to enact the violence. So there was something that God imprinted on her consciousness as a child that, you know, her religion had all of this violence attendant to it. And of course, it is. You watch that crucifix with the legs, you know, and she would have stared at that every day. And so it's a faith that gets grounded in an act of violence that has a redemptive intention to it. And so I think this gets, baptizes her imagination very young, and she uses this as a vehicle for revelation, but with the caveat that my characters, I don't think she doesn't make a gospel out of it. My characters' heads are so hard, she says, that nothing but some kind of violent action will alert them to a reality outside of themselves. So she puts that kind of caveat on it. My stories.
In my grade 3 class in Winnipeg, when the good sisters who taught us were wanted to give us a treat, we'd have to really behave all day, and they would read about the Jesuit martyrs and how they were tortured, you know, for us 9-year-olds.
I mean, I mean, those truths remain. There's a crucifix. There's the violence attended to the God-man that's at the heart of the faith that she has, and that informs her sensibilities. Meg?
How much of an influence does her health, or do you think her health problems had on any, or did, do you think there's any influence from her health problems on any of these musicians? I mean, is that anything, is it all literary influences, is there anything about her life as a very sick woman that appeals to them?
Yeah. Really, her writing life. She came home from, well, some of you have seen the film, right? She comes home aspiring to be a writer. She's 25 at the time, and she contracts the disease that killed her father, lupus erythematosus. She's watched her father die at a time when treatment was not available, a very horrible death. Flannery O'Connor said, my lupus has nothing to do with anything. And it's only lately that O'Connor scholarship under disability studies rubrics has started to look at the way in which her disease might have affected her. How can it not? She says, I was nothing but sick. But she did not want it to be counted as a factor in anything that informed her literary art. I don't get any of that from my understanding. I mean, I think a lot of people are not looking at O'Connor with the sense of her biography. Okay. They will look at her works. Some of them have seen John Huston's film of her first novel gone on to read that. But I don't think O'Connor's biography informs, other than a very dreadful song by a band called Killdozer that seems to relish in the fact that Flannery O'Connor died of lupus. It's called Lupus. It's just... mean-spirited. Yeah, that's the only one I know that makes reference to her disease and not in a way that is flattering at all. That was an hour of your Thursday that you spent here already. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Oh, okay, sorry, this question.
Why didn't you type so many words when you had the ability to communicate such complex ideas in such an eloquent way in such a short amount of time?
That's kind of this is my son, Jesse, born T-shirt.
Also called Flannery.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, that's so that you can take it with you. Okay, and which I hope some of you might do. Okay, thank you for spending this time. There is noshing available here. Thanks to.
And you just heard from an October 3rd book launch event at Novel Idea. Erwin Strait launching Flannery at the Grammys. It is about 57 minutes after 4 o'clock. First of all, thanks to all of you for tuning in to this first hour, and my thanks to Erwin for his wonderful event that evening and Gary Raspberry with his performance, and also, of course, Novel Idea. You are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC, and... just a reminder that both hours of this show are uploaded in my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Tell you what, before we move into the second hour, let's do this, and I will be right back.
Two out of three geese. Six out of seven seagulls. And this Transylvanian owl... all agree that if they had their own radios, they would tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Wouldn't it be cool if you could volunteer with Canada's oldest campus radio station? Well, sign up to volunteer with CFRC 101.9 FM today. We're always looking for new volunteers, and we offer a free training program, so no experience in radio production is necessary. You can start your own radio show or podcast, contribute to our news collective, help us sort through music sent to us by record labels and artists, help plan events, record PSAs for us, and even more. Reach out to our programming manager, Alex Fernandez, via email at programs@cfrc.ca for more information, or visit our website at cfrc.ca/volunteer and sign up today.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music.
a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
And welcome back now. We're